Amen. Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Get ready to take good notes. I said we're going to finish strong, and we're going to finish really strong in here, okay? So we're going to finish our Gospels look at, and then we're going to make it through the synoptic problem issue so that it'll set us up to work on historical Jesus when we get back, and then literary lens, and then theological lens, which if we get through all the stuff we do today, it'll be just fine. The reason why you want to take good notes is because this lecture, whatever we finish, you'll have a week and a half before we get to talk about it again. You're going to want to make sure your notes are good so that you can remember well. Does that make sense? So, the best way to finish is strong, and that's what we're doing. Sound good? You ready? Some of you are like, I refuse. I'm going to finish like terribly no matter what you say. Okay, that's your choice. I mean, you're an adult. We ready? Here we go. Yesterday we looked at the infancy gospel of Thomas as we switched from kind of the first century documents into the Celsus documents into the non-canonical gospels, and we're going to look at two more non-canonical gospels. First one was infancy gospel of Thomas. The second one will be the gospel of Peter. The gospel of Peter to me is quite fascinating because we have one document, one extant document. We know it is an incomplete document because the document begins halfway through a sentence. It seems to be a scribal training document. Examples of the document. I'm actually going to turn the lights off for this because you're going to want to see this. I wish when I was in Greek, I wish we would have done more, not just more Greek, but more manuscripts, because translating this is super fascinating. You get to know the author in a different way. But notice several different things. First of all, notice the graffiti at the end. He's doodling. Just doodling. This was in a tomb, a sarcophagus. It was one of the things that was in there. But he's doodling at the bottom. Why? He had extra space and just wanted to fill it in. But notice he makes mistakes at times and scratches it out. He adds a word and then realizes, shoot, I needed to add a definite article, so he puts it up there. He gets to the end of a line and runs out of space because a good scribe will have all of their endings the same place. So he draws a line over the top to say, this word has been shortened. So you have to kind of use your context to figure out what it is. But you can start, see also like handwriting styles. So his sigmas threw me off for a long time. But that's a sigma. It looks kind of like a C. It's a capital one, but he doesn't just do it with capitals. He also does it here, but because that's Simon Petros is what that word is right there, which is Simon Peter. But you have to kind of get used to the way that they write. You know, he has his chi, but his chi is bleeding into the next word. There's something about getting to know the manuscripts that you actually get to know the people. Some of the other difficulties is that you actually have the other side of the manuscript bleeding through the document. That's why it looks like it's double imaged. So there are times whenever a word on the other side might look a little bit difficult to see, but if you look at its reverse and see the way it's bleeding in, sometimes it bleeds in more clearly inverted than it does whenever you're looking at the actual letters themselves on the other side. Do you guys do this now in Greek 3? Do you do any of this stuff yet? Yeah, that's a bummer. Hopefully that'll change. Because this is actually what it is that the higher that you go that you should be dealing with is the actual manuscripts themselves and not just the translations of them. But the Gospel of Peter is interesting because of the way it portrays a couple of different characters in the narrative. It picks up around the time of Jesus' conviction. And then we get to see we get to see the tomb emptying. And so let me just read to you. I mean, there are some parallels, some minor differences with canonical gospels, like instead of my God, why have you forsaken me? In the Gospel of Peter, Jesus cries out, my power, you have forsaken me, which is different. Instead of take a guard, Pilate answered, go make the tomb as secure as you know how. It says, and Pilate gave them Petronius, the centurion, with soldiers to watch the sepulcher. So it actually gives us a name of a Roman centurion to watch the tomb, which is interesting if that name it's giving is preserving in some sense not just the one who is at the tomb, whenever Jesus arose, but maybe one that because of the tomb experience converted. So it's a fascinating addition. But then you have some major differences. Like, for example, the emptying of the tomb. This one's really fascinating. When therefore those soldiers saw that, they waked up the centurion and the elders, for they also were there keeping watch. That's an interesting detail addition. The Jews, yes, they had the Roman soldiers there, but the Jews were not content with just that. You have them there also at the tomb keeping watch. And while they were yet telling them the things which they had seen, they saw again three men come out of the sepulcher, and two of them sustaining the other one, and a cross following after them. So you have a couple of angels holding up Jesus, and then the cross just starts walking out. Apparently they buried the cross with him, which is different. And the two, they saw that their heads reached unto heaven. So now they're really tall people coming out, but of him that was led by them, that it overpassed the heavens. So Jesus' head is even higher than the heavens, which is different. And they heard a voice out of the heavens saying, "Hast thou preached unto them that sleep?" So have you preached to those that are sleepwalking? And an answer was heard from the cross saying, "Yeah." So now we have a really tall, talking cross with a bunch of really tall. So there's a little bit of a different feel. As a matter of fact, I remember Mark Moore once said, he said, if we were looking at a fabricated resurrection account in our Gospels, you would expect something a little bit more legendary, something a little bit more fantastic. And honestly, when I read the Gospel of Peter, I was going, that's what I would have expected. If it was something that was coming out of the imagination, sometimes there's just things that are beyond what it is that can be feasibly rectified. And that's what you find here. It's a bit different. A cross walking and talking with really tall people. You also see times there's a more clarification of the narrative, which is fascinating. Whether or not you agree with it is up to you. But he says, of the Jews, no one washed his hands, neither did Herod nor any of his judges. So remember how at the very end of the Gospels, you have Pilate washing his hands. Here it's saying they refuse. And whereas they would not wash, Pilate rose up. So you have this distinct contrast of stubbornness in the Gospel of Peter, which isn't a major difference until you realize it's not just a contrast of what's implicit. They actually later on blatantly admit their guilt. It says, then the Jews and the elders and the priests, when they perceived how great evil they had done themselves, began to lament and to say, woe unto our sins, the judgment and the end of Jerusalem is drawn near. That's different. I mean, yes, right here you can see that we have a difference as far as their refusal, their stubbornness, which that's implicit in the gospel narratives. Pilate, in a sense, saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm washing my hands of this, it's on you. We see that in the gospel narratives. An admission of guilt by the Jewish leaders, that's different. And Pilate even calling Jesus Son of God is different. Gospel of Peter says, Pilate answered and said, I am clear of the blood or from the blood of the Son of God. I'm innocent of it. But thus it seemed good unto you. This is your deal. But for Pilate to call Jesus the Son of God is a bit of a shift. So you can see the Gospel of Peter, it is adding in some fantastic things, as well as clarifying some things like the centurion being named Petronius, as well as emphasizing certain things. In the Gospel of Peter, the Jewish leaders are guilty, guilty, guilty. They know it, Pilate knows it, everyone knows it, which is a bit different. It adds a different dimension. Okay? What it's doing again, it's similar to what the Infancy Gospel of Thomas is doing. Infancy Gospel of Thomas was using our sanctified imaginations to fill in the gaps. And that's really what's happening here too. I mean, you ask the question, would the Jewish leaders have been content with allowing only the Roman guards to be at the tomb going, yeah, we're good. They wouldn't have sent anybody of their own. I mean, this was such a big deal. More than likely, the Jewish leaders, maybe they weren't right next to the Roman soldiers. Maybe the Roman soldiers didn't know that the Jewish leaders were there, but maybe the Jewish leaders were there. So what they're filling in is gaps, which I'm not suggesting then that we use that authoritatively or to even correct the canonical gospels. But at the same time, I find it to be helpful, influential. Does that make sense? Following me? Finish strong. Here we go. Gospel of Thomas. This is the big one. When people refer to the non-canonical gospels, the Gospel of Thomas is the one that gets the most press, and frankly, that in some sense has gotten the most, They really like this one. Let me just say it like that. As a matter of fact, the text itself we only have from three Greek fragments found in Oxyrhynchus, 3rd century. We do have a full Coptic manuscript from the Nag Hammadi Library, so you're talking 4th century. But some people try to date this as early as 50. Some people try to date this gospel earlier than the gospels because some will try to argue that this was used as a gospel source. As a matter of fact, once we talk about Q, this is exactly what they had envisioned Q would be before the Gospel of Thomas was even found. So when they found this, they were like, this is exactly what it was. We thought Q was going to be. This must be really, really early. Because what Gospel of Thomas is actually just a list of 114 sayings of Jesus. It just lists them without a narrative. It just lists a group of sayings. And without a narrative is huge. It's because what you're going to find in the historical Jesus, really in the synoptic problem, is that the narrative can be some of the difficulty. The narrative is where a lot of these, they will even accuse, a lot of the author crafting or inserting himself into the gospel. Whereas if we just had the sayings, so the story goes, if we just had the sayings, then it would be closer to the historical Jesus. So when they found the Gospel of Thomas, this was a huge move. But the Gospel of Thomas has some parallels that are clear to the Gospels, but also some very distinct differences. Some of the parallels. Both Gospels include the parable of the sower, frankly, in very similar terminology. I mean, almost identical terminology is what you find in Matthew 13. Both of them have this refrain, let anyone with ears listen. So this parabolic call, this proverbial call, he who has ears to hear, let him listen. Jesus in both of them compares the kingdom of God to the mustard seed in almost identical language. The phrase appears in both texts, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head and rest. So you see that in the Gospel of Thomas as well as in the canonical Gospels. So, both of them have, blessed are the poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Paralleling more Luke's Sermon on the Mount. So you see distinct parallels between them. So I don't want to present this as if the 114 sayings are completely off the reservation. They're not. They are parallel at times. However, at other times it's interesting. So you have Gospel of Thomas. This is saying 28. They just number the sayings. So there's 114. This is number 28. I took my place in the midst of the world, and I appeared to them in flesh. I found them all drunk, intoxicated, and I found none of them thirsty. That's a unique metaphor. I mean, it's not necessarily wrong, I guess. It's just different. It's a little bit fatalistic, a little bit pessimistic. I mean, he's just come down here. He's like, I came down here in the flesh, and what I find? A bunch of drunk crazies. I mean, you know, I'm not saying Jesus would never say that. It doesn't exactly match the picture of Jesus in the Gospels, but it's not, I guess, too far away. It starts to get a little different. He who will drink from my mouth will become like me. I mean, I'm not against the theosis embedded in this, although the Gnosticism here at the end is a little disturbing. I myself shall become he, and the things that are hidden will be revealed to him. This is actually one of the documents, as well as some of the way in which they word things, spell things, that Craig Evans is pointing towards some of the strong Gnostic tones, as well as some of the spellings. He's dating the Gospel of Thomas, and I agree with him, actually, more to the mid to late 2nd century, as opposed to 50, because we have no evidence of it being early 50. That's more falls into a theory that makes people feel more... I shouldn't say it like that. It falls into a theory that completes a theory more clearly in some people's eyes. However, when you look at some of the theology or the philosophy embedded in it, as well as some of the writing, the actual lettering, it seems to be more 2nd century-ish. But especially that Gnosticism, which isn't robust until the middle or the late of the second century. This last one, though, is a little interesting. I always find this fascinating that why Gospel of Thomas is so popular, especially, well, I'm not going to say that. The last saying, though, is pretty disturbing. Peter says, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Hello, way to end it on an up note, and to which she responds, well, "I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, for every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay, that does not sound like the Jesus of the Gospels. I'm sorry, I challenge that. No, never do I see that anybody that needs to enter the kingdom of heaven needs to be male. I just don't see that whatsoever in the Gospels remotely. You do have similarities between the Gospels, but you do have distinct differences. And the reason why then studying this is important is because, number one, yes, seeing similarities can show us how this can be instructive, but the differences are just as important. Whenever you're explaining a theology, sometimes you try to just explain what it is. I find it to be almost more important to say what it is not, because it's in the contrast where clarity comes. So the point of this is not to just tear down the Gospel of Thomas. The point of it, though, is to see where there is a dissonant note that is being played. And when the dissonant note is being played, then on some sense you're able to see the melody more clearly. So allow the dissonance to clarify the gospel message. Allow it, because the question then becomes with this is, how does Jesus in the canonical gospel speak of women? Is this seem to match the tone or tenor? The closest I could come to that I think would even remotely, too possible, but even then, you maybe have the Syrophoenician woman, but it's really not because she's a woman. It's really more, I think he's verbalizing what the disciples are thinking about a non-Jew. Or potentially the answer to the Sadducean question of this woman's been married 7 times over, they've all died, who's stuck with her? And Jesus says, don't you know that once we get to heaven, we'll all be like the angels? Although I think he's saying something drastically different than gender. I think he's describing something beyond that. I think he's describing the burden of the mess of the woman that they have as tapped into Tobit. Other than that, I have no idea where this would even remotely connect. Like whenever they come to Jesus and they want a divorce, they're like, "Hey, do you agree with Moses on the whole divorce issue?" Jesus' response is, "Here's your problem. And here was Moses' problem. You all treat women like objects, like pieces of property to be traded or cast aside, and they're not." That's Jesus' answer. "Don't you know that God made male and female in his image?" That's his first response. His second response is, "And then once they are married, they become one flesh." If you actually treated the wife as if she was a part of your flesh, you would not be asking me this question. So what I see is Jesus actually elevating the honor and the status of women, as opposed to this. Which again, the contrast helps us wrestle with, does this seem to match what Jesus was saying? Does that make sense how these can contribute? Holler if you hear me. Okay. Come on, we are so close. We got like 30 minutes. We can do this. Does that make sense? So maybe then I need to have you reflect and speak some, and maybe need to just not speak. That way you guys can wake up. What do you see over the last, however many documents we've looked at in the last 4 class periods, positives and negatives, questions, maybe things you're going, okay, I see the value in this. Or maybe something that struck you, wow, this parallel was fascinating to me. Or questions. Go. Yeah, I mean, on some sense, one of the things that's super fascinating is if you take away the Gospels and you just rely on all the texts that we have, you could construct a picture that of Jesus that at least points in the general trajectory of where the Gospels land. Now, I will say this, it doesn't get to where the Gospels accomplish. But you don't have nothing when you look outside of the Gospels. You have something, and it does affirm a lot, which is interesting. You know, especially whenever you come into, which I'm sorry, I don't mean to be pejorative here, but what I call very low-level apologetic conversations about the reliability of the gospel narrative. I'm going like, oh, you just haven't really read anything outside of the gospels, have you? Because the gospel narrative as a whole is pretty clear. I mean, from the enemies' mouths and from the very earliest strata, we have Jesus crucified under Pontius Pilate, and a mischievous superstition seems to take hold that they worship him as a god because they think he is alive somehow. I'm like, I'm not. I've just summarized the gospel story by using non-gospel texts. It's not a stretch. Right? Is that fair? That's helpful to know. What else?
Mm-hmm. I've always just wrestled with this idea of like how we can like accept or reject something if there is like some things of truth in it and like some falsehood in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, that like pulls me to a place where I'm thinking of like other like false religions and mm-hmm. things like that, where there is like a seed of truth in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And honestly, the thing about that is that used to bother me too. Because I believed, and I'm going to say this in as diplomatic as a way I can, I believe some of the hyper-conservative drivel about Christianity that said basically this. It's not just that we have the truth, we have the monopoly on the truth, and everybody else has none of the truth, they only have lies. That actually says something not about what we possess, it says something about who our God is from our perspective. I mean, reality is, that type of a God is one that cares not about anyone else except for those that have discovered the right thing. That's not who he is. As a matter of fact, the more that I've realized that there is truth in other places, and then I've compared that to what the Gospels especially reveal, I'm going, oh, that makes perfect sense. He is so desperately in pursuit of every single one of us that he's always going to put enough of himself into everything, frankly, because all of creation, even if it tries to purge him, will still contain parts of him because he's too pervasive. But he's going to have his place, he's going to position himself consistently so that anyone in any place at any time can reach out and touch him. I literally just quoted Acts 17. That's all that I just said. Therefore, the seeds of truth, which I like that metaphor you use there, because seeds, by their very reality, have the possibility or the potential to grow. These seeds of truth that are embedded in everything, points me back to the actual soil where we see these seeds develop fruit, and that is the Gospels themselves. That's the canon. Like, what is the canon? It is the fertile soil from which all fruit can grow. Even seeds found in other gospels outside of the canonical ones. Once put into the gospel soil, can actually produce some fruit. This is the concept of Jesus being your hermeneutic. How do we even know what truth is? Well, whenever you know it's a person and then you're able to see it. I mean, it's what Gandhi stumbled upon whenever he was reading the Gospels and his nonviolent revolution over India. Why was he so enamored with nonviolence? It's because he realized, I think, by his interaction with the Gospel narratives, which he admits, this seemed to work on that level, let's try it. And whenever it worked to overthrow an oppression over the entire country, he was overwhelmed. To which I would say, I mean, it's Jesus. I mean, there's also the challenge I always throw back at Christians and say, Gandhi shouldn't look more like Jesus than you do. Just throwing that out there. He probably shouldn't be the one that obeys the Sermon on the Mount better than you do. If you're a Christian empowered by the Holy Spirit that believes in the resurrected Christ. And yet, by God's grace, even a Gandhi can come face to face with him. That's crazy town love. That's out of control, furious, pursuing love. that the further we run, you still can't outrun the infinite God's love for you. Seeds of truth. So in other words, the very fact they exist in other religions, as opposed to it watering down the truth that we possess, it actually affirms what it is that's even more important than me having a monopoly on the truth, and that is the God of infinite love that is in pursuit of us furiously. Other thoughts or insights? Mm-hmm. Yeah, which happens a lot. I mean, what's interesting about that statement is actually the very fact that Jesus was crucified was because of a hermeneutic. That's something my mentor, Dr. Lowry, used to say all the time. He'd say, he was crucified for nothing more than hermeneutics. And it's because people had a different lens by which they were interpreting everything that led to his, not just rumors, that led to his execution. And the Christians are experiencing the same thing. And guess what? We experience the same thing today. It's kind of like the, honestly, at this point, maybe it's just because I've lived longer, but at this point I get so bored with the non-Christian. You know, Christians are just hypocrites. And I'm like, oh my gosh, come up with another accusation. This is so worn out. It's like, okay. And maybe the reason why you experience that dissonance is because we actually vocalize who it is we desire to be. While we are still sinners, we are vocalizing what it is we desire to be. Because guess what? I see hypocrites everywhere I look, in the church and outside of the church. The reason why it makes a lot more ground inside the church is because we've been honest enough to say that's not our goal. Our goal is not to be deceptive, even though we happen at times to be deceptive. But it's like, what do you mean by the word hypocrite? What do you even mean by that? Because guess what? I've had people that are Christians and non-Christians lie to my face. I've had people that are Christians and non-Christians steal from me. I've had Christians and that are non-Christians that have, you know, maligned me and slandered me. So I don't know exactly what you mean by hypocrite, because whenever I hear the word hypocrite, I hear you say the word human. And the thing that makes it something that's egregious is that Christians should be able, on some level, to live up to what it is through the Holy Spirit that Christ is calling us to. I agree with that. However, I'm also, at this point, a little sensitive to the fact that we're all in process. I'm going, I expect a Christian to still be, at times, struggling with things. Now, that's not the goal. Our goal is bigger than that. But it's like, come on. Let's get this old, worn-out accusation stuff really on the table. Really, what you're not really upset about right there is hypocrisy of Christians. What you're really running away from is the actual calling that you don't think is possible to live by because you haven't seen it in people, and that is holiness. You don't want that calling. And even if you did want it, you wouldn't think it was possible. And don't get me wrong, in-house, we'll talk about hypocrisy. But outside, going, come on, man. It's not hypocrisy, it's humanity. That's the problem. But accusations, my goodness, accusations, a lot of times, especially through ignorance, is driven by fear, but it's also self-preservation. Like, why is it that you falsely accuse someone? Usually when there's a false accusation, there is something that's being protected by the person that's accusing themselves, normally. Does that make sense? Have you experienced that? Next time you accuse somebody of something, you might want to do a little moment of a log check, see if it's coming out of your face, you know what I mean? Log in the eye? No? Anybody? Plank? Okay. Oh, I'm accusing someone. My question then is, what are you protecting? What are you protecting? I mean, you know, it's like one of the very first accusations that's even uttered in all of Scripture is, well, that woman that you gave me is the problem. Oh, Adam, you just accused God of what now? You threw God and Eve under the bus? At this point in the existence of the world, that's about all you got, bro. What's the problem? The only two that bear the image that I actually have marred. You and her. First accusation's protecting what? Himself. And then whenever he goes to Eve, Eve's like, it's the snake. She's like, I gotta find something else of intelligence to blame this on. Accusations are always preserving something, and usually it's yourself. Same thing in the Roman world. Oh, those Christians, a bunch of cannibals. What are they protecting? Bunch of anarchists. What are they protecting? Yeah? It's called the scapegoat, Rene Girard. Blame somebody else. Then whenever they die, you feel at peace. But it's a fake peace. It's one that goes away. Which is why I'm really interested that once this immigration problem is cured, quotation marks, then who will be the next person we need to sacrifice? That's where it gets a little disturbing on a societal level. It's just a new sacrificial lamb, the refugees and the immigrants. When will we stop and realize that the problem is in the mirror, not next door? We'll just keep running and acting like every time we kill somebody else, we're all like, hey, we did it, we did it. You know, and then the problem's not fixed. And so we pass it off to another group. And because, you know, just 10 years ago, the big thing we were supposed to be afraid of, and that was the problem, was, you know, terrorists. And now that's morphed because that's kind of run its course. After Osama bin Laden was killed, it was kind of like, oh, shoot, now what do we do? Well, good, I'm glad ISIS is coming together. Now we at least have some sacrificial lamb. But then now they've kind of fallen out of the headlines. So what do we worry about now? Oh, it's refugees, because don't you think terrorists will smuggle people in through refugees? As if refugees are just like walking into America like, shoot, man, nobody even checked me. I just walked right in. No one gets into the country by just walking in like that. What about down to Mexico? Okay, what's fascinating to me is if that's such an entry point, why wasn't that their tactic from day one? Just let that throw out there. But the reality is this, we have to find another scapegoat. Because if we don't find another scapegoat, we'll have to look in the mirror. And that's way more threatening, way more terrifying. So what do? We kill someone, we're like, we did it. And then it just passes. It's what they did to Jesus. It's what they did to the disciples. It's what they did to the Christian community. It's what humanity's been doing since the foundations of the earth. It's what Cain did to Abel. What's the problem? It's not my sacrifice. It's him. So if I kill him, then everything's better. No, not exactly. Other thoughts? Reflections, pushbacks, emotional outbursts. I almost feel like we need to keep talking about this as opposed to moving on to the next thing. Yeah.
Why are all of these called like non-canonical gospels when like literally they're so different from the gospels that are canonical?
Yeah, this the part of what you're wrestling with, and frankly what is difficult to wrestle with, is something that we utilize called genre, that we function as if it is a science. But the reality is that genre is a lot more artistic. Why? It's really difficult to do genre analysis because we know the genre when we're reading it intuitively, but sometimes it's really hard to, once you start to isolate, oh, this is what makes up the gospel genre. This. And the moment that you do that, the moment you're like, ugh, I mean, kind of. Like you make the list and you're like, I mean, I guess that feels good. But like I see this with the apocalypses all the time. Apocalyptic genre must be, and there's this huge definition that was written in the late mid-90s, mid to late 90s, and has been being fought over ever since. And Because an exact definition of a particular genre is both clear and unclear simultaneously. It's almost like what we're really doing in the genre, if I can use a metaphor to help explain something that by its very nature is metaphoric, it's almost like we're taking the sniff test. It's like, it kind of smells like a gospel. But exactly, but then now delineate to me what a you know, a cinnamon smell smells like. Go, list it. Okay. But even when you said that, you like didn't even believe yourself, right? That's genre analysis. It's not as if you don't know what cinnamon smells like, because if you smelled it, you'd be like, no, I know that's cinnamon. Right? But then try to map it out. And the moment you start to do that, which I'm not saying don't do that, I'm just saying know what we're dealing with here. When it comes to these gospels, when it comes to these non-canonical gospels, what other category would we put them in? I mean, it's this like, it's not like it's just a biography. It's not like it's Proverbs. It's not like it's an apocalypse, although there's apocalyptic elements inside of it. The closest we've got is a gospel. And that's really what's happening. It's a smell test. And that's what they land on, which I don't disagree with, but I'm a lot more comfortable with the imprecision of what is precise. Because I'm honestly, what I'm saying right now, there are some scholars that would go crazy over it. Oh no, we know exactly what a genre is. I'm like, yeah, to a certain point, and then comes the 1, 2, 3, 5 documents where you're like, I mean, they're kind of this, they kind of fall into that-ish. There's even major debates over whether or not gospel is even a genre that should be by itself. It doesn't seem to fit into a biography, though. It seems to be different. But the question is, was the gospel genre actually created by our writers, or was it something they were borrowing from? The closest that you have in the ancient world to the type of biography that's being written would be more like your Suetonius, which isn't until the early 2nd century. And there's a lot of people that even argue whether or not what Suetonius is doing is a brand new thing. Because most of the time what you have is a Tacitus-like movement, where he is, for the most part, trying to do a chronology as opposed in with the goal of character formation. Suetonius, man, he's not really worried about chronology. He's just kind of he's painting the picture through words of a person so that you know what to do and what not to do, or who to emulate and how to emulate, or what not to emulate and how to not emulate that. There's a different goal. Now, Plutarch takes it to a different level with Lives of the Illustrious Men. But is the gospel genre even separate? Is the gospel genre something that was created, or is it something being mimicked? It's a smell test. It doesn't smell exactly like Suetonius' Lives of the 12 Caesars, but it's not completely divorced from it. Does that make sense? So there's a part of it. Now let's reflect on this. How does that settle with what you learned in Principles? Does that bother you? Or are you going, no, I mean, at this point, I think that makes sense. Like, what's your reaction to that? I see some of you making verbalize what you are nodding with. When you compare what we're saying about all of this, from history to genre to what you learn in Principles, how does it interact with it? Yeah.
I recognize that the Gospels are a unique form of literature, and at the same time, historically speaking, the writers would have been influenced by culturally what they were acclimated to in regards to writing. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that they would utilize those popular means for writing, but the content and context of what they're writing is unique, and that finds its way into the normative writing style.
Yeah. And you know what? From a Christ in the Bible lens as a freshman, that might bother us, what was just said there. But at this point, your hermeneutic should be maturing to the point where that doesn't bother us. That actually makes it more richly beautiful of God weaving. This is what I love about our sacred texts, about the scriptures, the inspired word of God, is that like the incarnation, God refuses to divorce his revelation from us, from creation. He refuses. He refuses to skip a step and to be like, I'm going to become a man, but I'm going to skip the whole womb thing. And yeah, I'm going to come down here, but I'm going to skip the whole death thing. No, no, no. He's like, no, I will be born of a woman, and I will die like all humanity will die until I come back again. And I love that. But he does the same thing with our text. He doesn't say, oh, I'm going to write sacred text, but I'm going to bypass any of the genres or any of the influences. It's going to become a divine vacuum that I mechanically dictate to my writers. And they will have no option and no choice, and none of their personality and none of their preferences will be allowed in the text. It will only be a mechanical dictation. Or, let me say it this way. I will fully possess them by suppressing and eradicating their will so that only my will exists and they are obliterated. Wouldn't that be weird? Why does that strike you? The way I just said it there, why does that strike you as, whoa, that something's not right about that? What is not right about that? It's unloving. And why is that a problem? Because that's not who he is. See how that makes sense? That's not who he is. It's almost ridiculous to think like, what? God would never do that. Why? Because I know him. I know him. And there's no way he would run roughshod over you like a bull. That's not what he does. If that's what he does, then why did it take 400 years for him to finally say, Egypt, enough's enough. I've given you enough chances. It's time to just let my people go. Over. He's very patient. And then what it takes, another however many hundreds of years before God's finally going, oh my gosh, enough rebellion. Exile. And then what, another 500, 600 years before he's like, all right, we still couldn't get back on track with the exile. Here's my son. I mean, his patience with us is pretty overwhelming. We were studying yesterday at our College Heights preaching meeting. We were studying Jeremiah because we're going to be doing that in the summer. And whoa, Jeremiah 20. Holy cow. Jeremiah just takes the gloves off and starts swinging at God. I mean swinging. He's just like, enough's enough. I'm sick of this. Matter of fact, I'll even just read it. I was so startled, not just by what Jeremiah was saying, but by the fact that when Jeremiah said it, God didn't just immediately smite him. Because frankly, Jeremiah rivals Job. It's Job-like, but he makes Job look tame. In the way in which, because there's even no resolution. You never have Jeremiah coming back around going like, all right, I forgot, you are who you are. He just looks at him and he says, verse 7, you deceived me, Lord. That's how he starts off. Hello, and I was deceived. You tried to deceive me, and I fell for it. You overpowered me and prevailed. I am ridiculed all day long. Everyone mocks me. Whenever I speak, I cry out proclaiming violence and destruction. So the word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach all day long. But if I say, you know what? I will not even mention his word or speak anymore in his name. His word is in me like my heart, like a fire shut up in my bones. And I'm weary of holding it in, and indeed I cannot. He says, if I say it, they ridicule me. If I don't say it, it implodes me. Thanks for nothing, God. And then I think he keeps going, and he's in a mocking, sarcastic tone. Oh, I hear many whispers, terror on every side. Denounce him. Let's denounce him. All my friends are waiting for me to slip, saying, perhaps he will be deceived. Then we will prevail over him and take our revenge on him. Oh, but the Lord is with me like a mighty warrior, so my persecutors will stumble and not prevail. They will fail and be thoroughly disgraced. Their dishonor will never be forgotten. Lord Almighty, you who examine the righteous and probe the heart and mind, let me see your vengeance on them, for to you I have committed my cause. Sing to the Lord, give praise to the Lord. He rescues the life of the needy from the hands of the wicked. Cursed be the day I was born. May the day my mother bore me not be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought my father the news, who made him very glad, saying, a child is born to you, a son. May that man be like the towns the Lord overthrew without pity. May he hear wailing in the morning, a battle cry at noon. For he did not kill me in the womb. With my mother as my grave, her womb enlarged forever. Why did I ever come out of the womb to see trouble and sorrow and to end my days in shame? And that's how it ends. And I read that yesterday and I sat there and I thought, oh my gosh, the Lord is so incredibly loving and patient with us. Because that's both true and not true, what was just said there. That painted God out to be a villain, a monster, and that's not who God is. And yet, I know what Jeremiah feels like there. I mean, you know what I mean? I know what that feels like. To be like, what the heck, man? I gave my life to ministry, and I'm failing this class, and I'm struggling over here, and you know what? Forget you. You call me here and then you leave me out in the desert. Every time I say something back at home, they mock me. I'm struggling in the dorms with because these people who should be my friends are actually backstabbing me. And I did this for you? And here's what I love about Jeremiah 20 is I'm going, our God loves us enough that he wouldn't turn our face from us even in a moment like that. It's just not who he is. As a matter of fact, I read Jeremiah 20 and I compare it to the Gospels and I say, the contrast is startling. You overpowered me and prevailed. I'm going, the Gospels are emphatic. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do that. As a matter of fact, in a sense, it plays off of Jeremiah chapter 1 at the calling. And I loved it because Josh Huckabee was like, oh, I love the calling of Jeremiah. It's so inspiring. And I was like, and yet Jeremiah reads back this and he says it's terrible. The word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. And Jeremiah points back to the very womb metaphor of his calling and says, that's the problem. I wish I was never born. And God can use a foul-mouthed, arrogant, flailing child like Jeremiah to bring about his glorious revelation of the branch of David. Or the beautiful passage that comes 11 chapters after Jeremiah 20, Jeremiah 31, where he talks about taking our heart of stone and implanting it with a new heart. Our God will not overpower us even for our health. But to sit here and say that the Gospels were written by God overpowering the writers and divorcing them of any of their outside, so that none of the genres outside of them or none of the world outside of them would make its way at all, and simply is, frankly, an attack on the character of God more than it is an exaltation of the Scriptures themselves. That's an important thing to keep in mind. Whatever it is you're committing to, if it assails the character of God as revealed in the Gospels, question what you've just committed to. And on that note, have a good week of E. Love you guys. See you when you get back.